How many of these do you get?
Mattingly, get rid of those sideburns.
What you talking about, Willis?
Lend me your ears.
Oh, my God! They killed Kenny!
No, man!
Get two birds stoned at once.
References, idioms, inside jokes, allusions, jargon. These are all ways we can get to the heart of the matter with the people we're connected to. It makes you feel like part of the group. It's fun, but sometimes these shorthands can make others feel like outsiders. As we'll hear, they can also be used to bring outsiders in. It all depends on how you use them. You're listening to Infernal Communication, brought to you by Staffbase. I'm your host, Brian Tomlinson. Have you ever had one of those conversations with someone where it's just not working? Your jokes aren't landing, they don't get what you mean, you're speaking the same language, but you're just not connecting. It's off-putting, alienating even. But I think, or at least I hope, that we've all also had the completely opposite experience. It's often with a close friend, a coworker, or maybe a family member. Someone you've spent some serious time with. You just get each other. You have so many shared references, you can almost speak in code. Long-running television shows seem really good at giving us this kind of language. The Simpsons, Seinfeld, Friends, The Office. We've got years worth of references to throw back to. But for our purposes today, we're going to get, dare I say, nerdy. We are going to talk about Star Trek. Wait. Come back. I promise this will be good. And you'll learn a lot about coded language. But just bear with us for a minute as we dig into a fan favorite episode. How do we know it's so popular? We asked Ron Yamauchi.
I'm an unashamed Star Trek nerd. I've loved this show since I was 3 years old. All my dreams were set on a round room with flashing lights and a guy in a yellow shirt speaking in staccato ways to a guy who was talking like a robot. Oh, I just love that show. I loved it so much.
Ron loved that show. He was hooked on Star Trek at an early age.
I'm not really sure what started me on the Star Trek path. We had two channels in black and white. Grandpa only liked to watch Westerns.
In the suspense-filled tradition of high noon, the shooting.
And Mom liked The Edge of Night.
And now the second half of The Edge of Night.
Star Trek was neither of those, so I think it was just totally random.
Boldly go where no man has gone before.
I was 3 years old. I remember I've got these drawings of a rocket ship. It's the Enterprise, the rocket ship, and a little stick figure standing beside it, and that's me, and I'm helping. I don't know if you can see, because we're on podcast, but behind me is pages of Trekkinalia. I am immersed in this stuff.
Ron is into Star Trek. And right now, we're going to focus down on one episode in particular. It first aired on September 30th, 1991. It's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation called Darmok.
Darmok and Gillard at Tanagra.
I love this episode. I love The Next Generation, and I believe it.
We're here to talk about shared references, so let's make one together. But first, don't forget, our episode isn't about space aliens and phaser battles. It's about people trying to be understood. And so is Dharma, according to Sarah Rivera.
Yes, I'm Sarah Rivera, she, her, and I am a writer. I write fiction and poetry. I'm also a visual artist and a literary translator and educator.
Sarah teaches a writing class all about Darmok. She knows it inside and out and is going to give us a quick rundown of what happens. Let's dive in.
Engage.
Captain's log. Stardate 45047.2. The Enterprise is en route to the uninhabited Eladrell system. Wait. Come back. Sorry. That was for the fans. And for the non-fans, all you need to know is that Star Trek is set in space on the starship Enterprise. Captain Picard is the ship's captain. So here's the gist.
The basic premise is that the starship Enterprise has come to this uninhabited star system that is near the territory of this kind of enigmatic race of people called the Children of Tamar. And anytime the Federation, anytime humans have tried to make contact with the Tamarians before, they haven't been able to understand one another.
The two groups make contact from their respective ships. The crew of the Enterprise has a universal language translator, which normally makes everyone understandable.
Computer, search for the term Darmok in all linguistic databases.
I mean, it is the future. But in this case, they can understand the words the Temarians use, but not their meaning.
The Temarian captain, Dathan, repeats phrases like Chaka when the walls fell, or Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
So there are words in there that make sense, like when the walls fell, but the entire phrase has no discernible meaning.
Captain Picard is kidnapped by the Temarians and beamed onto a planet with Dathan, the Temarian captain.
At first, Picard thinks that Dathan wants them to fight because he keeps trying to hand him a dagger, but things never really escalate into a fight.
The two have to learn to understand each other.
Captain Dathan, the first night that they're camping out, gives Picard a torch and he says, Temba, his arms wide, when he gives him that fire. So Picard starts to understand that maybe the image of arms wide means something like generosity, like giving.
The next morning, the two captains hear a dangerous beast approaching.
And Dathan again says Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
And Picard starts to realize that maybe he's referring to a particular situation that is similar to their situation. That maybe the Temarians communicate by citing examples.
That's how you communicate, isn't it? By citing example!
The two captains have this beast to deal with, and they fight bravely, defeating the monster. But during the battle, Dathan is gravely wounded. Then, the next day,
Picard is with a wounded Dathan sitting by a fire at night, and he uses that phrase, Temba, his arms wide, to ask Dathan to give him more about the story of Darmok and Jalad.
You must tell me more.
The story is that Darmok and Jalad were these two heroes, and they both came alone separately to this island, and on this island they fought a beast. And after defeating the beast together, they became allies and they left the island together. So Picard realizes that Dathan brought him here so that they could face a common foe and learn to understand one another in the process.
And you knew from the tale of Darmok that a danger shared might sometimes bring two people together. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Dathan risked both of their lives in order to gain an understanding of each other. That's commitment. Dathan's wound is looking to be fatal, though, and he asks Picard for one last story. Picard tells him about one of humanity's oldest tales from the Epic of Gilgamesh, the part about losing one's companion.
And near the end of the story, Dathan breathes his last. And the next morning, the Enterprise crew finally manages to bring Picard back on board. But to do that, they had to attack the Temarians. So the two ships are in the middle of fighting. As soon as he's on board, Picard hails the Temarians, and he uses the phrases he's learned of their language to communicate what happened to Dathan and to show them that he's understood a piece of their language.
They part ways with a mutual understanding. Both sides put the work in to finally crack the code of mutual communication. And it sounds like a good watch. But more than that, Sarah sees a lot of takeaways and interesting concepts in Darmok, like the coded ways in which we speak to each other.
My best friend and I were talking about this in the context of the episode, and she told me, if I say to you, shocked Pikachu meme, you understand me. You know what meme I'm talking about, but my mom doesn't.
And here are a few other examples.
Juliet on her balcony sort of stands in for romance. Something like the kiss of Judas might stand in for betrayal. We have some of these shared images and allusions that we would understand in our own language, and they communicate entirely through those images.
It's something that we, as social beings, do quite naturally.
We're always creating like these private internal languages with people. And so it can draw us close together with people. It can create a shared foundation. And it can also create moments of exclusion or ways of excluding someone else from the conversation. And I think anyone who's ever been in a situation where you're around people who all have a completely different occupation than you, and they're speaking in the jargon of that occupation, and you just feel like it's a different language that you can't access, right?
We've all been on the giving and receiving end of this one. Like those special acronyms that you have when you go into a company. You know, like GRI, ABM, NBA, TMI, TLDR. Our superfan Ron was with the Canadian government for 3 decades. He was an investigator with the Human Rights Commission and involved with the Immigration and Refugee Board. He has seen heavy jargon in action.
We started to have people coming through the system with no lawyers. And it's a very, of course, intimidating system, all this legal jargon. And not being a lawyer myself, I had grappled with what this legal jargon means. I worked on trying to get our materials in plain language, using graphics and stuff that made sense to me. I tried to simplify it and not dumb it down, quite the opposite, make it clearer. Because I think sometimes specific jargon is a barrier that serves no function other than an in-group kind of professional lingo that you use to signal to other members of your tribe that you've gone through the requisite training rather than actually having a functional value.
And Ron, of course, draws a parallel with our Star Trek episode.
In Darmok, you have people who can't understand each other's references, but insist on using them anyway.
And then also,
you have people who need to talk to each other because very important. And they can almost make sense, but then you have to actually understand the person's perspective before you understand why they're using the words in the way they are.
Just as Sarah said, these insider vocabularies can bring people together or move them apart. As a writer and a teacher, she says using language that might be outside a reader's grasp can be a good thing.
So if I'm setting a story here in Albuquerque and I use so many Albuquerque references and I talk about Albuquerque street names and details of the Albuquerque weather, some people might worry that that alienates people who have never been here. But the idea of the particular universal, which is the quote from Joyce, is that when you are that particular and when you use specific detail, you are actually inviting people into the work in a different way because every reader has had their own experience of place that is equally specific.
The quote Sarah's referencing here from Irish writer James Joyce is, "I always write about Dublin because if I can get to the heart of Dublin, I can get to the heart of all the cities of the world. In the particular is contained the universal." His point was, instead of making stuff to appeal to a mass audience, make things that are specific, honest, and true to you. People will relate to this.
And so maybe they might not understand every single thing about that place, but it feels like a real place. It feels true. It feels fleshed out. We all live in the sensory world and we know what it feels like to be in a real place, that it feels that rich and complex and detailed. So that's why I encourage my students to dig into the five senses and dig into detail as much as they can and to allow details to enrich their language, because I think that there is truth to be found in that.
It's true, isn't it? With any storytelling, setting the scene, giving the reader, listener, watcher, whatever, a sense of place is such an important part of bringing a story to life. And as we say again and again, know your audience. You can't be all things to all people. So it's good to get specific about who you're writing for. Because Sarah doesn't want writers to default to an assumed audience.
There is a default white gaze, a default cisgender, heterosexual, white American reader in the American publishing industry. And writers are expected to frame their language towards that. And that comes up in the creative writing workshop when we're talking about, oh, what is relatable to the reader, or what is likable for the reader, or what do you have to translate or contextualize for the reader. So, for example, if I'm using Spanish phrases in my short story, somebody might ask me to include like an internal translation or not use so many so that I don't alienate this imagined reader with the language I'm choosing. But I've been thinking a lot about how that reader is not ultimately who I write for. And I think that writers are starting to interrogate this question quite a lot. If I'm writing for the audience that actually matters to me, for young Latinas, for second generation Americans, for people who feel like they're kind of between identities or on the margin of certain identities, then there are things that I don't have to translate. Then my foundational language shifts.
Darmok and Gillard at Tanagra.
Sarah can use Spanish phrases in her writing. That doesn't make it totally inaccessible for me, even if I don't speak it. So maybe I take a few minutes to translate it online, or I ask a friend who speaks Spanish. There are ways to overcome these hurdles that might even be good for me.
It's just a matter of who is expected to give a little bit more effort or who is expected to be on the outside versus the inside. And certainly there are books that are much more dense with particular references, right? You know, a famous novel like Ulysses by James Joyce is so outrageously dense with details of Dublin in Joyce's time, with in-jokes and references that you can only know if you understand the context, that it can be really difficult to read as a contemporary audience. But you still can. It just requires more effort. If you don't understand a few phrases, maybe that's okay, but you are connecting really deeply to a particular character experience, or you're connecting deeply to the arc of the story and where it ends up. So I think that there are different entry points for people.
This is bringing back memories of reading Shakespeare in high school. It was a little painful, but I read it anyway. And imagine if we only experienced books, movies, podcasts, and music that made us comfortable or was familiar to us. We'd miss out on a lot. Kind of like how social media algorithms can cause havoc in our lives today. Check that out in episode 4. I read Julius Caesar, so now when Lottie sneaks behind my back and steals my lunch out of the fridge, I can throw on things like, "Et tu, Brute!" with abandon. Sarah also finds the concept of a language based on past myths and events utterly fascinating. It feels like history is easily forgotten. We're so quick to move on from one thing to the next that historical context falls by the wayside. The Temarians would have a much harder time revising their history because it's baked into their language. How would things be different for us if we did the same?
Functionally, in their language, there's no present without the past. Everything in the present is seen through the framework of the past. And that's really interesting to me because I wonder if that was our language, if we could never forget elements of our past or the stories of our past because everything in our present is seen through that lens, what would change in our own value system? Maybe people would be less resistant to the idea that problems are systemic, right? That they have a history, or that things that are happening in our society today have happened previously in history. Maybe we wouldn't be able to sort of forget and re-narrativize the past as much as we do because we would understand the present through that framework.
But we don't. It's not how it works. Though, luckily, we have sci-fi to help us think through these issues. For example, first contact stories. Sarah teaches an entire writing course on them. People want to write and read them because it's a story we as humans seem to be drawn to again and again.
You know, one of the biggest movies recently was Jordan Peele's Nope, which was a first contact story. So people are still constantly taking this idea of humans and aliens, or humans and a completely new species interacting for the first time, and finding interesting themes and meanings using that framework. We have experienced first contact many times, right? Our human social groups have had many, many instances throughout our history of first contact. And that history has left a legacy in every country in the world.
And that can look like colonialism and violence, or it can leave a legacy of two cultures coming together.
Darmok and Gillard at Tanagra.
I think that sometimes sci-fi is sort of a space where people feel like they can explore these ideas without the sort of baggage and complexity and heavy emotion that comes from exploring our own human history. Sometimes having that degree of removal in sci-fi where we are thinking about colonialism or we are thinking about cultural contact, sometimes that gives people a space where they feel they can analyze those subjects. I feel strongly that speculative fiction is a way to talk about reality and a way to still reveal human truths.
And one of those truths is that mutual understanding nurtures empathy.
There's a Rachel Cusk quote from Outline, which is that the simple act of translation very often renders things harmless, which I found really interesting in the context of the end of this episode, where it's like, if we can create this small bridge of understanding, then we are less mysterious or dangerous to one another. That there is something so valuable just in the attempt and in the desire to open a door. And sometimes we will fail to communicate exactly what we want to communicate in the way we want to. And sometimes we'll communicate it better than we could have imagined and reach people that we didn't even think we could reach.
And speaking of reaching people who we didn't think we could reach, Ron was kind enough to come on our show and geek out on Star Trek. So we'll throw in this little plug.
The dream, honestly, is to get a little role on Star Trek, just to pop up and go, hi, I'm the 3-year-old kid that loved you in 1969.
So if any of you listeners out there can get Ron on some version of Star Trek, let us know. But in the meantime, science fiction is cool, right? Clarity and concise language is best, but don't be afraid to challenge your audience sometimes. Take a chance on a funny reference. Get specific. Be creative. If you know your audience well enough, they'll be right there with you. Your shared experiences mean something. Carry your universal translator, but on the odd occasion that it doesn't work, never forget, battling a beast together is the key to connection.
Darmok and Gillard at Tanagra.
Today, our guests were Sarah Rivera, an interdisciplinary artist, writer, and teacher from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Ron Yamauchi, a self-proclaimed Star Trek nerd, a former bureaucrat, and a soon-to-be Star Trek walk-on. Fingers crossed for you, Ron. I'm Brian Tomlinson, and this is Infernal Communication, brought to you by Staffbase, with production support from Jar Audio. Join us next time when we dive into... What did you say? Listening.
They call 911. They are upset. They're scared. They're nervous. When you're asking them questions, they don't even know what's going on.
If you enjoy the show, tell your friends, tell Dathan, tell the Temarians, and proclaim it over the loudspeaker of the Starship Enterprise. You can also follow us on your podcast app and leave a review. We'd love to know what you think. Until next time,